would like to remind you that for more Microsoft webcasts, you can go to microsoft.com/webcast. Thanks again for joining us for today's MSDN GeekSpeak webcast, Business Intelligence for the .NET Framework Developer, with Andrew Bruss. Now my pleasure to hand it over to your hosts, Glenn Gordon and Rachel LaPelle. Glenn, you have the floor.
Thanks very much, and I will add my welcome to that. And glad to see a lot of people joining us live for another episode of our Geek Speak. There's some familiar names in the attendee list, so welcome back. My name is Glenn Gordon, as mentioned. I'm a developer evangelist based in Atlanta with Microsoft, and my co-host on today's Geek Speak is Rachel LaPelle, based up in the fair city of New York. Rachel, how's it going?
Oh, it's going great. Great weather up here. Not quite as hot as Atlanta. Things are good.
Yep. So Rachel and I are work a lot with the community. We get involved in quite a few events. Sometimes we're doing presentations. Sometimes we're socializing and mingling with user groups. What's going on in your community up there?
Oh, we have a lot of great stuff going on. We did a presenter mentor last night. Tonight's our AltNet user group. We have SharePoint Saturday coming up. So there's a lot of great community activity here in the New York City area, Glenn.
Very cool. Yeah, down in Atlanta, we've got a couple of user groups forming around Windows Phone development, which is pretty exciting, and there's been a Silverlight group and a couple of .NET groups. And Rachel's blog and my blog are listed at the end of the slide deck, so you can check those out, and we have links to all the great local activities and community events that are going on in our areas. And we've got also, with PDC coming up in October, that's pretty exciting, isn't it? I think we're doing about 1,000 seats at the PDC in October up in Redmond, and we are really looking forward to a lot of the content because it's going to be streamed live, which will be really cool for the people who can't attend. So that's fantastic. Rachel, you still with us?
Yep.
Okay. So we've got our guest today who is up in Rachel's neck of the woods, and as I mentioned, with our visits to the user groups and other communities, we run into a lot of gurus, a lot of experts, and we like to use the GeekSpeak series as a way to get them in front of folks who can ask them questions real time and learn some interesting things that are maybe a little bit off the beaten path. So you want to go ahead and introduce Andrew?
Sure. So we have Andrew Brest, who works at 26 New York, which is a gold partner here in the city. And Andrew is just a short cab ride away from where I'm at, right in the city. He's down a little bit more south, and I'm up here in Midtown. And Andrew does quite a bit with BI solutions and a lot of great stuff with business intelligence in general and SQL. So, Andrew, are you ready?
I'm ready and set.
Yes.
Excellent. So, Andrew, why don't you give us a little bit of background about how you got interested specifically in SQL Server and that aspect of programming things?
Sure. Well, you know, going all the way back, I guess, to the beginning of my career as a programmer, I worked with databases. Before Visual Basic existed, and I started that from version 1, but before it existed, I was a DBase programmer. Actually, back to DBase 2.
Wow.
And then through 3 and various iterations of FoxPro before Microsoft bought it.
Did you ever venture into Clipper at all?
I was not a Clipper head. You know, that was, we have our religious wars now. The friendly religious war was FoxPro versus Clipper. So
yeah.
I was on the Fox side.
I was a Clipper head back then.
Oh, me too, Clipper head.
There you go.
You guys don't look old enough. anyhow, so, you know, my interest in data started all the way back then, and before long, I was on a project at a large bank here in New York where we were using SQL Server version 4.2, which was pretty much the first iteration that Microsoft built on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just flabbergasted. It was such a different kind of a thing than an ISAM, you know, file management, database management thing like DBase or like the Jet engine that was in Visual Basic and
right.
and is still in Access. So once I got hooked on SQL there, learned about stored procedures and such, I was kind of hooked. And then, you know, my foray into BI went on from there. But I won't go into all of that unless you ask me.
Okay. Well, our topic today is actually, you know, BI for a developer, and I think that it may be one of those things that developers think, well, that's somebody else's issue. You know, they're going to write some reports, and they're going to have that completely at their disposal. It's not something I need to code for. It's not something I need to build screens or write code to support. And is that generally true, or how has that changed maybe with the introduction of more advanced BI capabilities in the database platforms we have today?
Well, there still is kind of a great divide, really, between developers and BI. It's never something I've totally understood, but it's something I've long observed. There's something about business intelligence and the way it's sort of presented to experts and to the market that creates a perception that it's a very separate thing, and it ought not necessarily be part of a developer's toolbox the way a relational database is.
I see.
The reality is quite different, and actually, you know, one of the things you had there on my bio slide was that a few of us wrote a book on SQL Server for developers, and
mm-hmm.
we have a ton of content in that book just on the BI side of SQL Server. We believe that it's really a continuum, right? It's .NET plus SQL Server relational plus SQL Server analysis services on the BI side. It all kind of flows through a spectrum.
Well, I would assume that folks who come up to speed along that whole spectrum, they're more valuable than somebody who's just going to write some code and leave the rest to somebody else.
Well, they're certainly harder to find.
Yeah.
I won't make the judgment about value, but certainly they might be able to command more value in terms of their compensation because there is a shortage.
Right.
And they may
be more active participants in requirements analysis in the full software development lifecycle than they would think they would be otherwise.
You know, it's just a little less nuts and bolts than sort of dealing in tables and rows and columns.
Yeah.
It's really an outgrowth of all the same kind of technology, but you get to be a little strategic about what happens with the data instead of it all being kind of operational in terms
sure.
of just doing maintenance on the data. And that's why I got interested in it. As soon as SQL Server 7 came out and had an OLAP services component, I was just fascinated. I had done the relational stuff all the way back to DBase 2, if you want to call DBase 2 relational.
Yeah.
And I was hungry for more, so it really kind of grasped me that way.
Very cool. Well, based on what you mentioned about the previous slide has your book mentioned there, we're going to put links to for folks to purchase the book or as well as your blog and other resources on our GeekSpeak blog at the follow-up post. So once the show is done recording, give us a couple of days and we'll get it up there. So
great.
As we go through the demos today and start talking a little bit more in depth, there may also be questions that folks ask, so we will record those as well. But feel free to everybody who's attending live, type your questions in the Q&A pane and we'll discuss them. Rachel and Andrew and I'll discuss them. So in terms of what tools a developer has access to work with business intelligence data or reports or anything like that, do you have any demos on some of these things you could walk us through?
Yeah, absolutely. If you
okay.
don't mind, I'll share my desktop and show you some basic things to start with.
Sounds great.
Would that work? All right, let's take a look and see. And I'm hoping you're seeing what is actually my Visual Studio desktop, although it may not look like Visual Studio to you. There is this thing called Business Intelligence Developer Studio, or BIDS.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out BIDS really is Visual Studio. It's just a bunch of special project templates for reporting services, integration services, and analysis services.
Wow. And what version of Visual Studio does this become available with?
It is based in, assuming you're using SQL Server 2008 or
mm-hmm.
SQL Server 2008 R2, it's all going to be based in Visual Studio 2008.
Okay.
Which means that if you're running the newest Visual Studio and the newest SQL Server, you're actually going to have two versions of VS on your machine side by side. But that's okay. So what we have here is an analysis services project. And if you look at the Solution Explorer here on the right, you'll see that instead of files worth of code, I've got a data source. And if you've built SQL Reporting Services reports, that's going to be familiar to you,
okay.
and a data source view. And then I have this thing called a cube. And a cube is to the OLAP world, the BI world, what, in effect, kind of sort of what a table is to a relational database.
Okay.
But a cube, instead of having rows and columns, has what are called measures and dimensions. Now, if you take a look at the upper left-hand corner of the designer here, you'll see I have four measures listed out. And these are the numbers that we're going to be looking at when we do our analytical work. So this is actually a cube built, if you can believe it or not, from Northwind. I go back to Northwind because, well, first of all, it's a database most people still know. And second of all, I'd rather build a cube from scratch than have to use the one that's already built that comes with the product.
Okay.
Which is what AdventureWorks is. So we've got those four measures, and then we've got a bunch of these things called dimensions. And you can think of dimensions as just being categories that you're going to drill the numbers down by, the measures down by. So by setting up these dimensions, it will be very easy for me to look at total sales, for example, broken down by a country, let's say, on one axis, and then perhaps, if I can find the time dimension, my eyes just went a little funny on me, and also by year, for example. Now, where these things come from, though, is relational tables. If you take a look in the middle here, and we're running at a resolution such that we have to scroll around a little bit, but what we've done is we've put all the numerical information in one table. That's this table in the middle called TBL Fact in this case. And then all of these guys on the outside contain the dimensional information. And typically, but not always, they're denormalized. So notice my geography table up at the top in the middle here at 12 o'clock has countries, states, cities, and postal codes all in one table rather than each one being in a separate table. You can do it normalized, but the point is for analysis, you don't need to. So typically the way you build a database this way is either through a series of scripts or maybe a SQL Server Integration Services package. And once you've specified that in the data source view, and then you specify what you want your dimensions to be and what you want your measures to be, and you just map those to specific columns in these tables, then it goes ahead and builds the cube from that.
Mm-hmm.
So the cube really has the same information that's in a relational database, but the thing is it's actually stored in a way that's oriented around, again, those numbers and those categories that you drill the numbers down by.
Sure. And the difference here is that an OLTP, or a transactional database, is optimized for reads and writes of individual pieces of information. And here, you're sort of optimizing for, I guess, reporting, right, and doing roll-ups and drill-downs?
That's very well said. Yeah, I would even be a little bit more extreme than that. And I would say relational databases, for the most part, you said it very well. For the most part, they're built for writing data or for reading it one row at a time, which you absolutely said. What OLAP and analysis services is oriented around is reading stuff in some aggregate view.
Ah, okay.
Right. So I might want to aggregate my total sales by a supplier. I'm not going to want to look at every single sales transaction and look at the sale amount for that supplier. I want the cube to just give me the number as a single answer. Now, in a relational database, you can do that, but the way you do that is by group by queries and the few aggregate functions that exist in Transact SQL. And honestly, that's a pretty crude thing compared to what you can do in a cube. So if what you're trying to do is that kind of drill down analysis, you're much better off doing it in a cube. It's optimized for that. It can give you back the answers much more quickly. It can handle huge amounts of data. Oftentimes the answers are pre-calculated, so you don't actually have to sum them up in the way a relational query would have to do it. And what that means is you ask one question, you get the answer, now you can ask another one and another one and another one. And it's not the kind of bring the server to its knees experience that it might be on a relational database, even a data warehouse database. By the way, this thing in the middle here, this schema is called a star schema, and this actually portrays pretty well why it is, right? You have the fact table in the middle and all these spokes going out to the dimension tables, the ones with the blue bands on the top. And remember I said you can actually normalize your dimension. Mm-hmm. So we could have had four separate tables for geography. If we did that, then that would be called a snowflake schema as opposed to a star schema.
Ah, okay.
So that's where that vocabulary comes from. Go ahead. I can keep going unless you had a question or.
Now, Andrew, would it be fair to say that if you're going to keep them denormalized, it would help in performance, just like it would if you were doing just a plain old database and you denormalized it for a reporting tool? Would that be about the same in the BI world, or is it a little different?
It's much different. First of all, once the data is in the cube, it's in the cube. So it doesn't matter what the schema happened to be from the relational in the relational database from which the cube was built. But second of all, even if you were going against the relational database, and there is a way to do that, there's a storage option called ROLAP or relational OLAP where it actually does go back to the relational database. It's actually faster if it's denormalized because then you're not joining and scanning tables and
right.
Moving.
And your aggregates are pre-calculated at that point.
Depending on how you design the cube or your tables, yes, that may well be. You really have to, and maybe this is what keeps developers away sometimes, but you really do have to kind of reverse your instinct because, again, we're not doing operational data maintenance. We're doing strategic data analysis, mm-hmm. and for that, it's best to have everything physically clustered together so we don't have to do a whole bunch of work on the desk.
Good point. The last thing I want to say before you jump off this demo is, if developers are looking at your environment there, they see a solution, they see data sources and cubes and dimensions. If this were a web project, they would see ASPX pages and they would see code behind and style sheets and HTML. If this were a WinForms project, they'd see, you know, .cs files or .vb, and those would be forms and windows and so on. And those things will be run at runtime, and the user will interact with their application through a website or through a Windows application. What are people going to be using the cube and the dimensions that you built here? How are they going to be viewing that or running that?
Well, there is still an F5 option when you're in this kind of project, but it doesn't really run anything. It actually deploys your cube to the server.
Okay.
There is a little caveat to that, which happens to relate to the tab that I'm in right now, the calculations tab.
Mm-hmm.
What we're looking at here, even though it looks like a bunch of dialog boxes, is we're actually looking at a bunch of code. This is actually one big script. In fact, if I click on this button, you'll see the whole thing is one big MDX script. And
wow.
We don't have to worry about what all this is about today. But the reality is if you hit F5, you can actually debug this script. You can even set a breakpoint.
Interesting. So, in fact, the dialog boxes are the designer view for that script.
That's exactly right. It's a lot like a form designer versus looking at the .cs or the VB code behind what the designer generated.
Okay. So in the case of the cube, once it's published to the server, what are the options for consuming that? I guess if this were a database, the options to consume in the data would be you run SQL queries and you have select statements and whatever. How do you consume the cube? Or how do you set it up for you so your end users can consume the cube?
Right. So it's actually 100% analogous. You could use an end user query tool, and that's extremely common. One of the most common ones, as a matter of fact, is Excel. Excel 2007 on up turns out to be a first-class front end for an analysis services cube. But there are many other front ends on the market. Reporting services can go against cubes. And so can a number of third-party products as well. But, you know, and obviously this is sort of the point of why we're talking today, developers can write code against the cubes the same way they would against a relational database. The only difference is you use a different ADO.NET provider, and instead of writing your queries in T-SQL, you write them in this MDX language that I referred to before, which has a SQL-like look to it, but it's actually quite different.
Very cool. Okay,
And we can demo that as well if you're interested.
That'd be great, I think, yeah.
Okay.
Andrew, if Excel is, which it is, such a big, important tool in offices everywhere, and users get to use that to go and query your cubes.
Yep.
How does it help them become accurate? I see a lot of people using Access against like a SQL or Oracle database, and often they just get results and they think it's right. Is there any kind of issues like that if they're using Excel against a cube, or is it mostly protected by the way you set up the cube?
A great question, and we could do a whole show just on that, really. If we get to mention PowerPivot, besides the mention I just gave it, one of the reasons PowerPivot exists is to make analysis in Excel a little bit more, a little bit more regulated and devoid of some of the dangers you just expressed concern about. But that's kind of a separate topic. Excel is a very powerful tool, and with great power comes great responsibility, I guess. So you can really, you can mess things up in there if you want, but if you use Excel to go against a cube, you're actually in a much better place than the way most people use Excel to do data analysis, which is to pull data in from flat files or this database or that database, and then the data actually lives in the spreadsheet. Which means it can be changed, which means it can go out of date very quickly. That's not a happy place to be. But if you're building spreadsheets against cubes, the data's in the cube. And when you open up the spreadsheet next, the pivot table or the chart or however you're going against the cube, there are actually Excel formula functions to go against cubes as well. All that stuff refreshes itself unless you kind of explicitly detach the data source. It's cached. But it's very easily refreshed, and as soon as you drill down on something, it's going to go back to the cube and get the latest data.
Nice.
So a cube is actually a really responsible way to do Excel-based analysis, now that you mention it.
Yeah, sometimes we need to save ourselves from ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. look, let me just show you a couple of other things in the cube. I showed you kind of what the dimensions were, and let me double-click and show you, for example, how the geography dimension is defined, all right? And what you see I've got here is on the, we have three panes here, left, middle, and right. If you look on the right pane, that's the schema of the table that the dimension comes from.
Mm-hmm.
If you look on the left pane, you'll see all the columns represented there, although they don't have to be. But in this case, every single column we want available as something we can drill down by. That's called an attribute. So city, country, postal code, and state, those are all attributes. And then we also built a hierarchy, which is a drill path, where we say country comes first, and then within country you have states and provinces for countries that have them. Within that you have cities, and with that you have postal codes. So we'll be able to either drill directly by one of these attributes, or we can drill hierarchically through this drill path. And this is all defined through drag and drop, as it happens. If you're interested, though, and I'm guessing most developers are, this, too, is really just a front end for developing code. Let me show you what I mean. And the code is not what you might expect. If I right-click and say view code, which actually works in this context, just as if we were in a .NET project of some sort,
yeah.
You'll see, I just try to pull it full screen here, you'll see this big XML file, but this XML file follows a schema called XMLA, or which stands for XML for analysis. And this is actually the native scripting language that analysis services understands. And this is the data definition language script to build the dimension.
Wow.
And you see there's a dimension tag at the top, and then all these little attributes tell, like, the name of the dimension, the ID, and then its actual metadata. So all that happens when you hit F5 is each one of these things, or really all these things are combined to create a single script, and then that script is run on the server.
Huh.
That's all it is.
Have you worked with any other tools to generate those XMLA files besides Visual Studio, or is there a need to do that?
Well, believe it or not, in some of the work that 26 has done, we've written tools that generate those scripts.
Oh, okay.
And then run them on a scheduled basis. You don't typically have to go that low level because there is an object model API on top of XMLA. Actually,
mm-hmm.
There's two. But the one for doing sort of operational data definition language things is called AMO, which stands for Analysis Management Objects. So you've got a whole .NET object model that you can use, and when you do that, it's actually generating the corresponding XMLA script behind it. Instead of having to deal with all those tags, you know, the cube has a collection of dimensions and a collection of measures, and you can add things to the collection and remove them and so forth.
Very cool.
So it's something, it's a paradigm that I think most .NET developers would be comfortable with.
Okay.
So I just wanted to point out to you that in addition to the four measures that we have here, total sales, discount, unit sales, and average total sales, we have two more that are calculated. Something called adjusted sales, which is really simple. It's just total sales minus discount. And then this thing, adjusted sales growth, this is a little more complicated, but not as bad as you might think. If I just highlight this little bit, what this is, What this is saying is, I want you to take the adjusted sales, and then I want you to divide it by the adjusted sales based on the hierarchy that I just showed you, the year, quarter, month, and date hierarchy,
mm-hmm.
and the previous member of that. Now, what does previous member mean? It's all context sensitive. So what this means is if you happen to be drilling down by year, then this will take the current year's adjusted sales and divide it by last year's.
Wow.
And if it's the month, it'll divide it by the previous month. And if it's the quarter, it'll divide it by the previous quarter. Whatever your drill context is, this will figure out the previous period, divide one by the other, and then I'm subtracting one just so we can get a growth percentage. And that will just appear as a measure to any query tool you use. So you can include it in a select clause, right? And all this sort of, you know, more complex stuff, it all just lives in the cube. This is much more expressive about this kind of analysis than anything in SQL ever could be, right?
Or anything in Excel, you know, assuming you pulled all the data down to that, too.
By and large, that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of stuff we can do. Also, let's suppose I want to drill down not by all cities, but just three specific ones. For example, Albuquerque, Boise, and Kirkland. I define a set, and I'll be able to use the name of this set in a query and just get back the data for those three cities. So there's a lot of cool stuff you can put in the cube, and you, or, you know, more importantly, users can take advantage of that later on without having to deal with all the complexity of it.
Wow.
Okay, now, Andrew, with the cubes, since you said everything goes in the cube,
mm-hmm.
Are there nightly scripts or something that you need to run to keep the cube fresh and to keep the data in it constantly active and current?
Another excellent question, and that process is called processing the cube. What you're kind of referencing is whether it's possible and or necessary to do kind of an incremental processing. In most cases, the answer is yes, and it depends on the application and the user base, you know, what kind of tolerance there is around how frequently or infrequently that's going to be done. So in some cases, you're looking at month-end data, and you can run that refresh once a month. In other cases, people want it near real time, and there are ways to do that. But yes, you do need to refresh the cube in order to keep the cube current, and you can actually build you can actually create SQL agent jobs that do just that. And in fact, that XMLA language I spoke about before, there's commands in there to go ahead and process the cube.
Nice.
So you can write such a script and then schedule an agent job to go ahead and run it.
Okay, so for an example like this, if it's adjusted sales and adjusted sales growth, you might run that, say, once a month when people need to get reports about that data.
It depends how, yeah, I mean, yes, but it depends how they're using the cube, right? We actually like to promote a notion of BI that it shouldn't just be thought of as a reporting thing that you're going to do at month end. It should be thought as something that you can go to get up to date and really actionable information. And obviously, in those cases, we have to go ahead and you know, make sure the refresh happens on a frequent basis, once a night at least.
Okay.
There are lots more tabs here, and we're not going to have time to go through all of them, obviously, but I just wanted to point out one, the perspectives tab here. And what I've done is I've defined a perspective called product info. And a perspective is really just a checklist of things in the main cube that you wish to include in a new version of the cube with this name. So we've included all the measures and two dimensions, suppliers and products, the KPI, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, and one of the actions, as well as the two calculated guides that I showed you. What that means is that a front-end application will look at product info and will see it as another cube that happens to, sales and product info will look equally important. The fact is, though, that product info is just kind of a masked view of sales, and that can be very useful if you're building a really complex cube and putting tons of stuff in it, but you want your users not to be sort of overwhelmed with all the dimensions and all the measures, you can build out a perspective as well.
Okay.
All right. So what I'm going to do now, I think, is take us out of full screen mode here and then flip us over to SQL Management Studio so I can show you a couple of queries against this cube, if that would be all right.
Sure.
We have a question from Craig.
Sure. He's wanting to know if we have some time. Can we show some of the presentation tools consuming the cubes in a .NET app and some of the scenarios you might do that in?
Yeah. So, well, you tell me if I didn't follow the question, or I'll let Craig tell us. But what I want to do is just show you the query grammar a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I want to do is take you to some .NET code.
Great.
That is a Windows Forms application that will actually go ahead, hit the cube, and run queries similar to these.
Gotcha.
And bring back the results.
Okay, super.
So this is a simple query, and I want to warn you, because this looks so much like SQL that you're going to think it's a lot like SQL, and it really isn't. But at first it appears that way. The most of the time when you query the cube, you're going to ask for sort of a two-dimensional result set. So it's almost going to look like a regular relational result set. You specify, it's like a crosstab, really. You specify what it is you want to see going across the columns and what it is you want to see on the rows, and also what number it is you want to analyze. What this is saying, and bear with me, because to have this in the where clause is going to be very confusing to people, but what this says is I want to see the total sales, and I want to break it down by shipper name going across and year going down. And if I hit execute, that won't work because I had part of the query selected. If I hit execute now, you'll see we get that data back. And you see how it's broken down? And instead of, imagine if this were relational, that whole thing on the left that says all and calendar 96, 97, and 98, those wouldn't be there, right?
Right.
So you'd have to deal with it some other way. You probably have to have another column, basically, with the year. Anyway, so this is really meant for analysis, and this is intrinsic to the way the query grammar works. You should also notice, maybe it wasn't totally obvious, but that came back pretty quickly. This isn't really a great way to prove how quick this is, because this is a rather trivial cube. It's just not that big.
Yeah, it's 0.03 of a second, according to your status bar there.
Yeah, there you go. So, but this came back pretty fast. And then there's ways to make it even faster by designing aggregations so that these numbers are actually already in the cube, and all this does is it has to pull it out. It doesn't actually have to add anything up. Let me go a little bit more complex here to another query. And in this one, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say I want to see countries going across, and I want to see the children of the beverages product category going down the rows. Now, what are the children? They're all the different beverages that we have in the product dimension, which we've set up hierarchically to have a category name and then a product name.
Huh.
And it's total sales that we want to see once again. And by the way, the from clause references the cube it is that we want to see. Once again, I need to make sure the text isn't selected. And you see that came back pretty quickly too. So now we've got in alphabetical order, as it happens, all of the different products in the beverage product category, and we are getting the total sales by country for each one of those. And do you see what I mean? That you get this answer back quickly, and then you get excited and you say, okay, now let me see it this way. Now let me see it that way, right?
Yeah.
And in the old days, which I remember because I was the victim of them, that every one of those would have had to have been like a different report that
right.
I would have had to write for somebody. Now people can basically answer a lot of those questions on their own, and they can probably go further because they can do it in a very, you know, kind of dynamic way without having to make a request and wait for the report to be built and so forth.
Sure. Now, are those column and row headers clickable?
Not in this tool. I mean, yeah, it'll select the row, but it's not going to store it.
Okay, because it looks like it almost looks like a button that you should be able to drill down with it. But.
That's just the way the guys who did the analysis services stuff in Management Studio decided to do it.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right. It does look like buttons. It's not, though. Now, look here. Suppose I want specific members, right? I don't want to say generically give me children of, you know, beverages or generically give me all the members of something. I'm saying I want to see the total sales by year specifically for Speedy Express and Federal Shipping, which are two of the shippers in the shippers table. And I'll click Execute, and that comes back very quickly, too. So you start to see how, you know, MDX can be a very complex thing, but the thing of it is you only need to know a small part of it to be productive and to get really good utility out of it.
Is there a designer view, like, for your T-SQL queries?
This is sort of it. The difference is, and by the way, notice product info and sales are each listed here. If I click on sales and I drill down to products, what I can do is, I don't know, suppose I want a product's category name. I can actually drag and drop this. So it gives me a little help by inserting the right text.
Okay.
And that's about all there is. There is also a list of functions here. All the functions in MDX are listed and broken down categorically here. And you start to see, you know, what's going on, right? Try and do this in SQL. You can do this in Excel, but try and do all these things in SQL, you're going to have a problem. But so all of these things can be dragged and dropped as well. And I think if you do that, it actually sort of gives you a prompt, if you will, for the parameters. It's not exactly IntelliSense,
sure.
But you do get syntax code coloring if you notice that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let me just show you one or two other queries. Let's see if, well, okay, that where clause in all the queries we've looked at looks so strange. So let me show you one that makes a little more sense. Now, this really will act like you would expect the where clause to act. This becomes a condition, right? It's saying I want to see the shippers going across, the years going down, I want to see total sales, and I only want to see it for items that are in the condiments product category. So this is going to look the same, but it's applying a filter. And technically, this is a filter too. That's going to blow most people's minds. But it's a filter in that you're filtering what particular metric it is you want to look at. There's other ways to do this, though, so that this doesn't end up in the where clause. And with hindsight, I kind of wish I did some of these a little differently. But that's okay. This works if you take it on faith and authority. Let's see. Let me show you a cross-join, and then I think we're ready to move over to the .NET code, barring any questions. What this is going to do is give me shippers going across. Then what it's going to do is give me years, and within each year, it's going to give me every single country in the cube. And
okay.
It's going to show me the total sales for that, and it's going to filter it by condiments. So here we go again. And now, let me scroll past the all, because the all makes it kind of a little hard to fathom. But so here's calendar 96, and then within 96, I have each country, Argentina, Austria, et cetera. And then once I get down to the end of the alphabet here, which is, I guess, Venezuela, and then unknown, which is kind of everything that didn't have a country in it, in the source data, then it starts again in 97, right? And this is how you build hierarchical things with drill down. This is how reporting services does it, and in effect, this is how other tools do it as well.
So you've got that. The cross join is what's putting the year and the country
headers that's to the left of your
it's
row.
It's nesting them,
nesting
right?
Them.
So it's basically it's saying, I want to see country within year or
Got
year
it.
And then country within it. And that's what cross-join means.
And what's putting the word calendar there, is that something you got from the data or is that intrinsic?
That is in the dimension itself.
Okay.
When you build a time dimension, Analysis Services understands that it's special and that it's time,
mm-hmm.
and it will kind of inject that for you if you'd like. It's to make the distinction between calendar and fiscal, because typically with cubes you tend to drill down by both because there's so many financial scenarios
mm-hmm.
where you use this technology. So that's why Analysis Services has it as just kind of a primitive built-in thing.
Cool.
And then one last one before we move over to the code, and this one shows you how specific you can get. And this is important for an app developer, because imagine if we're showing shippers going across and years going down, and then within years we're also showing countries, just like we were before. Now imagine somebody clicks on Canada and they click on US, and you want to show the states and provinces within those two because they drilled them down. That's what this drill down member function does. It says show me the countries, and specifically for Canada and US, show me the children of those members. And so if we run this and I scroll down to, let's go down to 1996, bear with me as we scroll. Notice after Canada we see Quebec, and that's all we had data for in 96. And then after USA, we see Idaho and New Mexico and Washington. And then for everybody else, it's just countries. So that's how you would satisfy the query. If somebody drilled down on USA, you would take your pre-existing query and modify it with the drill down member clause so that you could get back the child information as well. And you could paint that out. I think that's enough MDX, and I think it probably makes sense to show how we can actually apply this.
That sounds good. Remember, folks that are watching us live, you can type your questions in the Q&A pane.
Good deal. So here's a very ugly Battleship Gray Windows Forms thing, but it'll do the trick. This is just a scrolling text box, all right? And I've got a couple of buttons underneath it that are going to run the MDX query that's in that text box and bring back the results.
All right.
And there's no less than four different ways to do the query. Let me show you the first one because it'll look so darn familiar for anyone who's done any ADO.NET programming. All right? The first thing I'm going to do is open a connection object. In this case, it's an ADO-MD connection object rather than, say, a SQL connection object because we're using a different provider. The connection string, let's just see if I can go to where that was defined. Oh, sorry. That's going to get loaded up by one of the other text boxes in the form. Specifically, it's basically going to look at what you selected for your server, your database, and so forth, and it's going to build a connection string out of that. But the syntax is the same. It's data source equal and initial catalog equals. And then it's just ADO.NET. Then what we're actually going to do is have a data adapter and a data table and a command object. And the command object, instead of getting a SQL query, gets the MDX query out of that text box. It gets the ADO-MD connection. And then down here, here's our data adapter. We call fill on it. We fill up a data table. And then we have a data grid view control, and we set its data source equal to the data table. All right, and then there's other ways to do it. Let me run this before I show you the code behind some of the other ways.
So in essence, the result of your query is itself rows and columns, and that's what you're binding to the grid view.
It depends which kind of object you retrieve the data into. If you retrieve it with a data reader or a data adapter, then in effect, what Analysis Services does is it flattens the result set if it happens to have more than three axes in it, and it brings it back as a tabular result set. There is also the possibility, which I'll show you in a minute, and things are running a little slowly just because I have so many things going on this machine, but there is the possibility to bring back a special object called a cell set object, which
okay.
is And here we go, picking that Chapter 16 database we were just looking at. I'll click OK here, and I'll go ahead and click Sales, and I'll click Data. And let me just click that button that we already saw the code behind, and you see it just comes back in a data grid.
Yeah.
You can also bring it back as XML, which I do in this button, using an XML reader, and then I have a special XSLT sheet that can transform it to look like the HTML that you're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
XMLA can bring it back exactly the same. Now, what if I did a query like this? This actually has three axes. Notice it has columns and rows, like we saw, and then it has a third axis called pages. Well, there's an object called a cell set that can handle things that have more than two axes. And you see what I've done is I've brought it back into a list view control. That's actually what this is. And you see this drop-down list? I looked at the cell set and looked at the members in its pages collection. And by default, we're getting everything, but I could pick a specific year.
Huh.
And the point is the cell set can specify to you what the answers are for each of those 3 years.
And all, when you're changing that, you're not firing another query off to the server, right?
That's right. This is all stored in one cell set, and the only thing we're doing is iterating through a different part of it and filling up the list view control. The other thing that is important is that you have access to metadata as well. So if I just want to get a list of dimensions, I have a way to do that, right? See, here are all the dimensions, and that actually comes back as a data table. This is important because the way you tend to write BI applications is by giving people the choices of what they can kind of query by.
Yeah.
And then you generate the query and you execute it. So I can bring back dimensions. I can bring back measures. I can even bring back things like calculated members. So all those calculations that we saw before, we can bring back, and I can even look at the MDX that you and I saw in the editor before.
Sure. Right. So, yeah, I mean, in this kind of scenario, using the metadata to give a user who's doing the analysis choices and options to select, that's much different from, you know, a report that would be very tabular and sort of be analogous to a printed paper. So I see where that would be very valuable. Yeah.
There's good scenarios for both. If you're domain specific and you know what your queries are, then you don't have to ask people to compose them. You can just bring them back, and maybe you parameterize them so that they can specify a given year or a given product or what have you.
Sure.
And there's lots of other stuff. You can actually just write code that will create a database or add a dimension. That's using that AMO. So the two APIs we're using are ADOMD.net, which is that ADO.net provider, and AMO, which is the analysis management objects. You use the first one to query the cube and get some of the metadata, and you use the second one, AMO, to get it all the metadata plus to do things administratively against the cube. Everything that you can do in SQL Management Studio against the cube and really in an analysis services project, that can all be done programmatically using AMO if you want to, which means you could build your own front end and define your own cube dynamically. You don't even have to use the tools.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, Andrew, we actually have some questions in the QA queue.
Very good.
First one being, and this is a good question, if there's any concerns or considerations about SQL injection. So, I suppose if you were putting this out on the web, allowing people to dynamically be able to query these cubes, what about security and SQL injection?
Well, I mean, that is a good question. By and large, the good news is that because OLAP cubes tend to be read-only databases, we don't have to worry about what might get injected. Because, you know, there's a select grammar. There's no insert grammar. There's no update grammar. There's no delete grammar.
Okay.
There is actually a function called writeback where you can actually put stuff into the cube, and that's usually done to create like a what-if scenario. However, the chances of having that injected are pretty low because it's a pretty obscure feature, and only certain applications even allow it. In fact, it's not until this most recent version of Excel 2010, that Excel supports writeback. So it'd be pretty hard to find an application that you could compromise in the first place. And even if you could, what you're really doing is modifying a secondary store and not the original.
Okay.
Okay, that sounds good.
Were there a couple other in the queue?
Let's see, one more came in. It was just administrative. So you could go on.
All right. Well, what I want to show you now is how you can take what you know about ADOMD.net and then combine it with Visual Studio tools for Office and actually do some pretty cool stuff in Excel. So, you know, I've got a breakpoint set here. Let me just run this. This is an Excel add-in created using Visual Studio Tools for Office. And this is actually an Excel 2007 because that's actually how old the sample is. But I do have a version of this running in 2010. I just didn't want to risk surprises here. But you see, this is just C# code that's looping through. Here's the connection object. It has a cubes collection. Here's the index into the cubes collection, and that has a dimensions collection. And I'm just going to loop through the dimensions collection and then loop through the measures collection, and I'm going to do that to populate some drop-down lists, and you'll see in a moment why. If I click on this OLAP tab, this is my add-in, okay? And if you've never built add-ins with Visual Studio Tools for Office, you may just be kind of impressed by the fact that you can do that all by itself.
The days of macros are in the past.
Well, yes and no. I mean, yeah. To some extent, like if I click here, I'm going to actually create a pivot table against the cube. And in effect, this is a macro, right?
Sure.
It's C# code, but it's largely the same as the VBA code you might run.
Right.
So far, this actually doesn't use ADOMD.net. It's just using Excel's capability to query a cube. And by the way, this is going to do the same thing. It's going to make a chart off of that pivot table. And I think it's a pretty nice looking chart, too. Although through once this gets through a live meeting, it may not be as pretty as it looks to me. But what I can also do is I have this task pane. Okay, and this is, if you've never built an add-in, this is really just a user control. And the code you saw was the code in the user control. And remember, I said we were going to populate some drop-down lists, right? So here's a dimension. And you didn't see it, but the click event there populated this list, which gives me all of the attributes in that dimension. And let me click on a blank sheet here. And now I'm going to click Insert Members. And what I actually did there was I didn't query the cube, I generated formulas. You see this function here, cube member?
Yeah.
That is a function built into both Excel 2007 and 2010 that can go against a cube and bring back the value of a specific member in a dimension. The next thing I can do is pick a measure. Let's try that one more time. Okay, pick a measure, total sales. Right? And now I'm going to click Add Measure, and that just went to the cube live, okay? It used another function called cube value to do that. Now what's cool about this is a spreadsheet formula. Notice it's referencing cell A2, which has the country that I want to get the total sales for. And what that also means is I can just pull this handle down, and it'll get all the others live from the cube.
Wow, that's cool.
Now what we did was we combined the BI capabilities of Excel with our .NET capabilities and ADOMD.NET to create the add-in and to basically load up our UI. So we're really getting the best of both worlds. And then because this is Excel, you can do stuff like, you know, we could put data bars on here and make it look a little nicer, and we could format the whole thing like a table.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to pick some fairly bad color combinations here because that's my habit. But we could then we could give this whole thing a range name, and then we could share it up to SharePoint using Excel services. Likewise, we could share up the pivot table and the chart and in effect create a dashboard just by using the things that we learned about OLAP and the things that we learned about writing .NET code against OLAP.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah, that's very impressive.
I love that. Something that brings to mind looking at this graph that's in here, I know one of the things that people have trouble understanding a good use for is WPF, right? And WPF is used to maybe make better end-user experiences than maybe a WinForms application. But because of all the 3D capabilities of WPF, I'd always thought it'd be interesting to have controls at render charts and everything within that 3D space. Have you seen anything on the market that lets you build sort of OLAP visioning cubes and that sort of thing from WPF?
Well, first of all, good point, right? I mean, the power of XAML and the power of OLAP put together are a natural combination. As natural as they are, not a whole lot of people have taken advantage of that and really done exciting things with it.
Okay.
I do know of a product from a company that I think a lot of people will have heard of called Dundas, or Dundas, depending on how you pronounce it, which side of the border you live on.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a product called Dundas Dashboard, which now that it's in version 2, is fully capable of querying cubes and doing all kinds of lovely data visualizations against it. Now, that doesn't use WPF, but it does use Silverlight.
Oh, okay.
So they have really kind of taken that whole idea of XAML plus OLAP, our 2 4-letter acronyms, and run with it and produce something that's really, really nice. It's a product I've been evaluating, and I recommend it quite highly.
Okay. Any community samples out there doing something similar, or?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question comprehensively.
Okay.
The last time I really spelunked around, there weren't lots and lots of them, but, you know, I think things are going to change, especially because of that power pivot thing that maybe we'll talk about another time. But Power Pivot, as it turns out, is an add-in for Excel that brings really a new version of analysis services to the desktop and lets you build cubes without even know you're building cubes and then query them in Excel.
Yeah, since the demos of it, it's pretty amazing.
And I think that's going to end up popularizing cubes quite a bit. And by the way, those cubes really are cubes. The same APIs that I just showed you work against Power Pivot models if they're deployed to SharePoint. So it's just a slightly different connection string, and otherwise everything else just works. So I think this is going to start to get a lot more mainstream, and I think the samples are really going to flourish.
Very cool. Well, Andrew, we are just about out of time, so I've moved us up to the resources slide for GeekSpeak, and we've got your blog listed on here as well as Rachel's and mine. You have the source code available for what you showed here today, or is it part of your book, or what?
It is. It's all from the book, and
okay.
And the companion code from the book is on the Microsoft Press site. I could easily send you a URL.
Okay. We will add that to our post show notes.
Very good. And that'll just go straight to the zip file that has all the code, and this all came from chapters 16 and 17.
Excellent. And what other types of things do you blog about? Do you focus on BI, or what other topics could people look to you for?
I do focus on BI once in a while, but my blog, which, by the way, is also syndicated right on the home pages of Visual Studio Magazine and Redmond Developer News, really focuses on strategy for working with Microsoft technologies and working with Microsoft.
Excellent.
It's called Redmond Diary when it runs on the magazines, and it's sort of an outgrowth of my column, which is called Redmond Review.
Fantastic.
Yep.
Good. Well, we've also got on this slide links to our GeekSpeak blogs that you can check there for post-show resources. And our upcoming GeekSpeak webcasts are listed on msdngeekspeak.com. And a lot of our recordings, including this one, are up on Channel 9. So, folks, if you liked it, you can share it with your friends. So, Andrew, thanks very much for coming on. I think it was a really engaging topic and some good conversations.
Thank you. It was fun.
And, Rachel, thanks for co-hosting.
Thanks, Glenn. Thanks, Andrew.
At this point, we'll turn it back over to our webcast producer to do some final wrap-up.